We get things underway this hour by welcoming back to the program a multi-talented performer, singer, songwriter, producer, arranger, music historian, author, actor. He's done it all through the years, and we had such a great time talking with him a few years ago. We said we've got to get him back on to tell some more stories. Billy Vera joins us this afternoon. Billy, welcome back.
Good to be with you, man.
How are you doing in these challenging times?
Well, I'm getting a lot of solitary time here at the house. They're not letting anybody out here in L.A.
Yeah, it's pretty much the same thing here. They're encouraging people to stay home. Just about everything is closed up. So, yeah, we're all getting to know the interior of the house a whole lot better.
Yeah, you bet. Well, it is what it is, man, so we'll fight through it.
Darn right. We'll make the most of it here. And in the meantime, it gives us a chance to talk more with you because there were so many stories and so many people that you've worked with in your career that we didn't get a chance to talk about last time around. And I wanted to just throw out a few names and talk about your relationship with them. And one that stood out to me in your wonderful memoir, Harlem to Hollywood, was Donna McKechnie, the wonderful Broadway star. Can you talk about what she did to help you out in your career?
Well, Donna was married to my then manager, a fellow by the name of Al Schwartz. And Donna had been the lead dancer on a television show called Hullabaloo. And so I got to know her a little bit back then, and she gave me some good advice about, you know, she was one of the great dancers of the time, and she showed me the best way to stand on a stage. She said, stand with your legs a little bit spread apart. She said, women like that. So I did, and it worked pretty good.
Another person who had a big influence on your career, can you talk a little bit about Murray Barber, who is a fascinating character in your book?
Yeah, Murray had passed away, and he was a sort of a Broadway Danny Rose type character, if you remember that, Woody Allen.
I sure do.
And he was it could have been written about him, about Murray. And he managed a group at one time called the Elegants, who had one number one record and then never made the charts again.
Little Star, was that?
Star.
Yeah.
Yeah, they were good. In fact, Vito, the lead singer of the Elegants, he is now a talent agent in New York, and a very nice guy, by the way. But Murray was one of these guys. He had a lot of big ideas, you know. He sort of an overinflated idea of himself, and nothing ever seemed to work out for poor Murray. I hooked him up with my sister, who was an excellent singer, and I had taught her how to write songs, and so she wound up writing some good songs, too. And she was a pretty girl, and Murray somehow managed to get her an audition with Creed Taylor, not to be confused with my songwriting mentor, Chip Taylor. But Creed had come out of, you know, the jazz field, and he had produced Stan Getz, Desafinado, and Girl from Ipanema, and, you know, Jimmy Smith, Walk on the Wild Side. And on the strength of that, he started his own label, CTI Records, which became quite successful at making pop jazz albums, you know. And so he wanted to try something a little different, and when he heard my sister, he really liked her, and she was sort of I don't want to say a folk singer, but she was sort of that Woodstocky kind of era type of singer and songwriter, and good at it. So Murray gets the and Creed had heard a song of mine called Good Morning Blues, which had been the B-side of a hit record I had called With Pen in Hand. And he wanted to cut it with George Benson. And he did. And And of course, just as the album was about to come out, Creed gets the bright idea to do a jazz version of Abbey Road with George Benson. So the other album with my song on it got sort of put aside, and it came out about, I don't know, 15 years later, after George had really hit it big. Anyway, so to record my sister, Creed got Rudy Van Gelder's studio over there in New Jersey, which is where all the great jazz albums on Blue Note and all these other labels had been recorded. And it was quite a big deal. But Murray, to fatten the game, he comes up with an idea that to have publishing on the songs that my sister wrote, and that the publishing would be divided between Creed, my sister, myself, and Murray. But the way he presented it to me was that this publishing company would publish everything that Creed put out on his label, which would have been, you know, an amazing deal had it come off, except that, you know, Murray had a way of presenting it to me that didn't sound as outlandish as it really was. Why on earth would Creed Taylor want to get into a deal like that, you know? And, of course, that ended, you know, my almost relationship with Creed Taylor.
And was it Murray that tried to get you together with legendary producer Lou Adler?
Well, how that came about is Murray had a friend out here in L.A. I was still living in New York, and I hadn't had any luck getting a record deal after, you know, the music had changed, and I just didn't, there was no room really basically for what was known as a blue-eyed soul singer at that time, and I couldn't figure out how to fit in with the new music. I couldn't very well be a heavy metal guy, and I sure wasn't going to do disco, and, you know, I wasn't going to be one of those wimpy singer-songwriters that became popular at that time. You know, so I was trying to find a place for myself and a style that was original and that record companies could find in their minds that might be something that might sell. So Murray says, listen, I got this friend out in L.A. He owns the studio where Richie Valens used to record, and he's willing to give you 6 weeks of free studio time to make a record. You know, all you got to do is supply your musicians. So I got my bass player and my drummer to come out to California with me, and we spent 6 weeks out here making an album, just the three of us. And so Murray takes it around to a couple of places, and he ends up going to this this guy that worked for Lou Adler. I can't remember his name right now. He was a well-known jazz saxophonist, and he was sort of Lou Adler's listener, you know, and he loved it. And so he plays it for Lou, and Lou loved it. And Lou called me up, and he said, man, by the way, Lou Adler had just come off of what was at that time the biggest album ever made, Tapestry by Carole King.
Right.
And he said, man, you are just what I'm looking for. You're a guy that everybody in the industry respects, and nobody's ever been able to really figure out what to do with you. And I think I can. And it would be great for my ego to be the one that does for you what I did for Carole King. That sounded pretty good to me.
Yeah.
You know, so he says, now what I want you to do is I want you to call me collect every day He says, I'm finishing up Carol's follow-up album to Tapestry, and as soon as I finish that, I want to get with you. Oh, before that, he flies to New York and books time at a studio for me to just sit at the piano and play the same songs for him without a band. And that's when he said all this that I just told you.
Mm.
And so I dutifully called him, and he's filling my head with all these great things he wants to do for me and how he thinks how great I am and all this stuff. This goes on for over a week. And finally, one day he says, okay, he says, listen, I'm just about finished with Carol's album now, and I'm ready to get busy with you. He said, have your manager call me, and we'll make the deal. So I called up Murray, and I said, listen, Murray, I know how you can get. I said, you know, you're not making a deal for Elvis Presley here. You know, I'm a guy that hasn't had a hit record in about 4 years, 3 years, whatever it was. I said, this guy can do what I need done for my career. I said, I want to do this. I said, so whatever he offers, if it's not ridiculously, you know, in his favor and not in mine, take it. I said, just don't play the big shot this time. Don't worry, Billy. I'll take care of it. So I was, as instructed, I called Lou the next day. By now, his secretary, my new best friend, oh, hey, Billy, yeah, he's in there. I'll put him on. And then she comes back, and she says, well, he's on another call right now, but, he'll just hold on, and he'll get on with you. Well, I'm on the line for a half hour. No Lou. Finally, she comes back, and she's got this sound in her voice that doesn't sound good to me. You know, she's like, she wants to be loyal to her boss and not say anything, but she likes me, and she doesn't want to, hurt my feelings. And she says, well, Lou had to run out. But, call back tomorrow. And so I called back tomorrow, and I called back the next day. Never was ever able to get him on the phone again. Now, this was at a time in my life when, my career was really nowhere. And I just knew in my heart that Murray had screwed it up. And I said, what the hell did you ask for? I said, Murray, I know how you can get, and if you screwed this up, you and I are done. And he just didn't know what he had done, the poor guy. And the rest of his career, I fired him after that, but the rest of his career, he did similar things with other people. It was always like, he had big shot dreams, I call it. He fancied himself Colonel Parker or something.
We're talking
Colonel Biberman,
We're talking with Billy Vera here on Downtown. Billy, your name came up a couple of weeks ago on the show. We were talking with Gene Cornish of the Rascals.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I just read his book.
Yeah, that's what he was on talking with us about. That was a great book.
Yeah, it was, and of course, a lot of that, I was in that world during that period.
Well, yeah, we were talking about your thoughts and your comments along with his about the great Arif Martin.
Oh, Arif was just a wonderful man. He was a great arranger, and he was a real gentleman, at Atlantic Records, he arranged my record with Pen in Hand, and he did a couple other things for me in Atlantic as well. In fact, when I did my Capitol album some years later, a lot of years later, He did the string charts on that as well, that Tom Dowd produced.
Last time you were on, we talked about your acting career, and we didn't have time for you to tell one of my favorite stories in your book. Can you tell a little bit of the story of how you hit it off with director Blake Edwards?
Oh, Blake. Yeah. For those that don't know Blake Edwards, he did some just wonderful movies, you know, over the years that everybody would know, you know. He's just a great director. And so we were hired to do this movie Blind Date, which starred Bruce Willis in his first big movie role after he had gotten famous on a television show called Moonlighting. And I had met Bruce before, I think about the week after the first episode of Moonlighting. I had seen it, and I said, boy, who is this guy? He's going to be a star. You know, you could just tell. Well, he shows up at this club we were playing, and he comes up to me in the middle of my set, and he said, hey, man, I saw your name on the marquee out front, and I just had to come in. He said, I'm a big fan of yours. He said, Peter Weller, he said, I was a bartender at Peter Weller's club in New York, and Peter bought 200 copies of your album and gave it to his friends, and that's how I became a fan of yours. I said, wait a minute. I said, aren't you that guy on that new show with Cybill Shepherd? He said, yeah. I said, dude, I said, you're going to be big. You mark my words. So from that point onward, he started coming to all our shows, you know, until he got so famous that people were bugging him, you know, and he couldn't sit at a table and enjoy the show. So it was nice that we ended up doing this movie with him. And of course, the beautiful Kim Basinger was in it as well. So they brought me over to meet Blake, and he was doing a scene with just Kim alone, and they were setting up doing a lighting change, and so we had a chance to talk a bit. And he said, "Oh, you know what?" He said, "Julie and I used to go see a lot of music." He said, "I heard your music, and I really loved it." He said, "You got that old time feeling with real songs." He said, "Not just a bunch of bullshit, you know, words thrown together." He says, "You're a real songwriter, you know." And I said, "Wait a minute, you?" And he said, "We used to go see all the, you know, big jazz stars." I said, "Wait, you've known Julie that long?" Julie Andrews. He was married to her.
Right.
I said, "You've been married to her that long? I didn't realize that." He said, "Oh yeah." I said, "I've been banging Mary Poppins for 20 years." So I knew this was a test. So I knew I'd better come back with something clever, you know, that was what he was testing to see if I could on my feet and whether I was intimidated by him. So I said, "Wow, that must be really something." I said, "What does she do? She jumps up on the roof with that little umbrella from Song of Music and jumps off and lands sitting on your face?" And he just takes a beat, you know, and he looks at me right in the eye and says, "You are a sick man. We're going to have a lot of fun together." And we did, you know. And I remember one scene we did. It was a nightclub scene, and we're playing, and it was the scene where Bruce has been chasing Kim because she had gotten drunk on their blind date, and she sort of went off, and he was worried about her, and she ends up in this nightclub where we're playing, and a brawl breaks out. So without telling me, Blake sends two stunt women up to attack me because he wanted a natural reaction from me. And so in the old days, when I played a lot of clubs where there were not just fist fights, but gunfights. I mean, all kinds of brawls, knife fights. I would pick up my microphone stand and start swinging it to keep the people away from the fighters. And so I started to do that. But in the scuffle, my leg got cut. My pants. I'm bleeding. And we went through. We finished the scene. And so the next day, Joe Dunn, who had been Blake's lead stuntman for 20 years, he and all the stunt guys came in the next day, and they brought me an official stuntman's T-shirt and cap and badge. He said, "You are now one of us. You're an official stuntman." And I said, "Man, I can't think of a greater award to get than that."
Billy Vera with us here on Downtown. In your book, and I need you to address this because, well, I know others who have dealt with this fate. Billy, you say you've had a lifelong addiction to narcissistic beauties.
Yes, I have. I've never done drugs. I've never done alcohol or cigarettes or any of the usual addictions that most musicians have. But and I think that came from when I was very young. My mother was a singer, and a lot of times when I was a little boy, I'd have to go with her to the shows, for lack of when there wasn't a babysitter. And so I'd be in the dressing room with, a room full of half-naked dancers and singers, and just sitting around in their underwear. And, I'm a cute little boy, and they all sitting me up on their laps, on their half-naked laps, and pinching me and kissing me and making a fuss over this little boy. And so I just sort of assumed that that's what my life was going to be, surrounded by beautiful girls. And when I went into show business, I found that, you could look like a gorilla and have the brain of a toad, and pretty girls are going to chase after you when you're on that stage. There's something about being on stage that's attractive. They see you as the most powerful figure in the room, and that attracts a certain type of female. And usually the ones that are the most beautiful tend to be rather narcissistic. They've been told all their life how beautiful they are and how great they are, and they believe it. And for some twisted psychological reason, I've always found that attractive and can't say no to them. Right. Now I'm an old man, they don't come banging on my door calling me up on the phone at 2 o'clock in the morning anymore. But for many years they did, and that became an addiction. And I was in therapy largely about that one problem, until one time my therapist, who was this by that time an old lady, and she said, "You know what your problem is? You're only attracted to exceptionally beautiful women." She said, if you could only fall in love with a normal woman, a secretary, a hairdresser, or, just a normal woman, you'd probably do a lot better for yourself. A nurse, school teacher, but you have to have these actresses, she said, "I've been a therapist for 35 years, and I've treated some of the biggest, most famous actresses and the biggest nobodies in town. And I'll tell you, every single one of them has been a narcissist." She said, "So, you're fighting the odds when you go after women like that."
Yeah, absolutely.
So, but it was a lesson that she was never able to teach me.
Billy, want to talk a little bit about your newest book, which is just great. Rip It Up, the specialty record story. You posted a wonderful picture the other day of your longtime friend, Mr. Arthur Newton Goldberg, best known to the world as Art Roop. And what an amazing story he's got.
He's an amazing man. He's 102 years old now. And I go up to, he lives up in Santa Barbara now, and he runs his philanthropic foundation up there 5 days a week. And the women at the office tell me that he works harder than any of them. Although he says, "Oh, I only work five hours a day now at 102, you know." But I'll tell you something, he's sharper than any five people I know put together. You know, he's got an amazing memory, and he's got an amazing mind. I mean, I've known some really smart people in my day, and he's up there with any of them.
Well, we know about specialty records and what they did with Little Richard, the Soul Stirrers, but some performers that people may not be familiar with, can you talk a little bit about really the first big success for Art Roop and specialty, Roy Milton?
Yeah, Roy Milton was almost 40 years old by the time he made his first record. And, you know, at the time, you know, Art liked the big bands, you know, like Lucky Millinder, the big black bands, Erskine Hawkins, Count Basie, and a lot of those people. But he didn't have any money to do sessions with, you know, 15 or 18 men. So he noticed that Louis Jordan was popular, and he had a five-piece band. So he heard Roy with his band, and they were that small combo size. And he said, "You know, I bet if I rehearse these guys before we go in the studio, and if we are careful with the arrangements, and we can make them sound almost like one of the big bands." And that's what he did. And, you know, he had, like, I think 18 top 10 records over a decade that Roy was with Specialty Records. In fact, he told me once, he said, "I know in the end," he said, "Roy sold more records than Little Richard did." Mm. Of course, you know, that music, you know, Roy's music didn't cross over to the white teenage market.
Right. You also make a pretty compelling case for the first rock and roll record not being the one that gets a lot of the credit, Rocket 88, Jackie Brenson, but Jimmy Liggins' song.
Yeah, Jimmy had a record. Jimmy Liggins was the younger brother of Joe Liggins, who had a huge record on another label called The Honey Dripper that reputedly sold 3 million records. I don't know. It's hard to know that because so much hyperbole. But Jimmy had a record called Cadillac Boogie, 1947, which is but 5 years before Rocket 88. And I'll tell you, to my ears, it's got that wildness that didn't exist in other R&B records in 1947. There were 47 was a great year for rhythm and blues, although it wasn't called rhythm and blues yet. Called race music,
right?
At the time, which was not a bad word. It was actually a word of pride that black people used with pride. But at any rate, you had Louis Jordan, you had Wynonie Harris, you had T-Bone Walker, you had a lot of real great rhythm and blues records in 1947, but they didn't sound like they were out of control, which I thought was a major component of what made rock and roll different than rhythm and blues. Aside from the subject matter,
right?
You know, cars. You know, cars was something that teenagers could relate to, and of course, black music in the 40s was not really written for teenagers. The whole idea of teenagers was not a thing yet. You know, I mean, of course there were people in their teens, but...
Right, but it wasn't this special class of people that had music and other products geared specifically toward them.
I couldn't have said it better. You know, it wasn't until the boomer generation came along and that there were so many of them, and thus they became a market, even as little kids. You know, special records were made for these little kids, you know, little yellow records that, you know, with Bugs Bunny and all that stuff, or hula hoops or slinkies or special toys for these little special kids. And by the time they became teenagers, they, you know, America was doing pretty well economy-wise. And so there was money and allowances, money that they could spend of their own, which, you know, people in their teens didn't really have before that. And so then they started saying, well, why not market records for teenagers? You know, and they became a thing to be exploited.
And indeed they were. Yeah, absolutely. Billy's book is wonderful about specialty records. It's called Rip It Up, The Specialty Record Story. Also, check out the terrific memoir and the documentary based on it, Harlem to Hollywood, the brand new album as well, which is wonderful. Billy, it's great to talk with you again. We so appreciate you making some time for us this afternoon. Be well and be safe out there in that in the isolation we're all in, and hopefully we can all get out of the house sometime soon.
Yeah. Well, stay healthy yourself, buddy. Thanks for having me.
You bet. Thank you, Billy. We'll do it again. That's Billy Vera with us here on Downtown.